underwriting support for the Book Show podcast on WAMC.org comes from Northshire Bookstore, Manchester Center, Vermont, and Saratoga Springs, New York. An independent bookstore offering books, author events, gifts for children and adults, and more. Northshire.com. And from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a new Bachelor of Science degree in Public Health with a focus on social, physical, and behavioral sciences. strose.edu.
Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Min-Jin Lee's historical novel Pachinko spans the entire 20th century through four generations, three wars, and two countries with a troubled past. A moving and powerful account of one of the world's most persecuted immigrant communities, Koreans living in Japan. Lee highlights the complexities of being an immigrant and striving for a better life when resigned to a second-class status. The title comes from a popular type of adult pinball game, pachinko, which originated in Japan in the first half of the 20th century. Min-Jin Lee's debut novel, Free Food for Millionaires, was a New York Times editor's choice and one of the top 10 novels of the year for the Times of London, NPR's Fresh Air, and USA Today. Again, the name of the new novel is Pachinko, and it is a great pleasure to welcome Min-Jin Lee to this week's book show. Thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Joe. Thank you so much for having me on your show.
So nice to have you on the program. What brought you to want to tell this saga over so many years and look at the long-term ramifications?
I actually learned about the Koreans in Japan when I was 19 years old, and I'm 48 now. So I've actually had this story with me for about three decades. I attended a lecture when I was in college, and in the lecture, an American missionary who worked with the Koreans in Japan discussed the very difficult history of the Koreans in Japan. But then what really made a big impression on me was a little story that he told about a young boy who was 13 years old who climbed up to the top of his apartment building and he leaped to his death. Naturally, his parents were devastated and they tried to understand why that their son would do such a thing. And they went through his things and they found a middle school yearbook because a little boy had just graduated. And in the middle school yearbook, his classmates, who are Japanese, had written, "Go back to where you belong." They had written that you smell like kimchi and that we hate you. And most importantly, they wrote these words, "Die, die, die." And the little boy was born in Japan and his parents were born in Japan. And I think that this story made such a huge impression on me because I was not born in America. I'm a naturalized American citizen. And the young boy's experience was so different from mine. And I really had a hard time imagining that this could actually occur.
So when you have that story in you for so long and you come up, I assume you come up with questions that you ultimately want to tackle, right?
Oh, absolutely. I had so many questions. Namely, I really couldn't understand that an entire society would allow other children to believe in something that was so heinous, basically based on your birth and your blood. Because if you are in Japan at any time, you realize that you really can't tell the difference between the Koreans and the Japanese, at least phenotypically. And in terms of culture, because they've lived in Japan for such a long time, it's really impossible to understand the differences because many of these Koreans in Japan have never been to Korea. So they're culturally, socially Japanese, and yet the people around them refuse to see them as anything but ethnically Korean. And of the ethnic Koreans, they are viewed even today as people of suspect moral character. And that was really hard for me to understand.
And it's one of those things that an atrocity is difficult to, it's hard to get your brain around something that just isn't designed to make sense.
Absolutely. I think we're always questioning how evil works. I always thought that Hannah Arendt's work, The Banality of Evil, really made a lot of sense to me because even people who are well-educated and thoughtful have such a difficult time understanding hatred and the hatred that could even lead to genocide. In the case of the Koreans in Japan, there was a lot of deaths that occurred. And although initially it started out with this question of something really, really tragic, the more time that I spent in Japan between 2007 and 2011, 4 years, I realized that the Koreans in Japan didn't see themselves as just historical victims. They saw themselves as really tough, interesting survivors. And very often they looked at me when I interviewed them with great amusement because they thought that my concern about their history was, I think they thought it was interesting, but they also thought that I was overreacting at the terrible things that had happened to them and continue to happen to them because their attitude is, this is just the way things are and you have to keep adapting.
When you decided to take this on, you actually went to go live in Korea, correct?
I lived in, I was born in Korea. I've traveled there quite a bit, and I came when I was 7 from Korea to America, and I've naturalized. And I lived in Japan from 2007 to 2011 for 4 years.
And through that time in Japan, was it just life in general, or was it to specifically work on this?
Oh, I actually went there because my husband got a job,
mm-hmm.
and we needed the money, and he got a promotion, so that's why we went. And it was not a really great time for me because my first book had just come out, and I had left basically 3 months after its publication. So I was really sad about that, but then I thought I would go back to this manuscript that I had written and finished about the Koreans in Japan. It was a novel, but it wasn't very good. And then once I got on the ground, I started to meet lots and lots of Koreans in Japan, and I did a lot of research, and I did field work. And I learned why that book that I had written before wasn't very good. And it's primarily because I had focused so much on the sad stories rather than focusing on the fact that the Koreans in Japan didn't see themselves in the way that I saw them.
This story begins in the early 20th century when Korea is already under Japanese rule. Tell us about this child. She's 16 years old.
Mm-hmm. Sanja is essentially a teenage mom. She's a young girl, and she is the beloved child of two boarding house keepers. They don't own the boarding house. They're just managing it. And they're doing it to make extra money because during the colonial era, the Koreans became more and more impoverished because they were taxed very heavily and the inflation was quite rampant. So they take in some boarders. They have this child, Sanja, who is so deeply wanted because the father of Sanja, Huni, he had disabilities, and it was difficult for him to have children and to get married. Anyway, so Sanja has a kind of a happy childhood, and she falls in love one day when she goes to the market, and she becomes enamored with a very powerful business person who ends up becoming the father of her first child, and he cannot marry her because he's already married in Japan.
This is, as we read the story, her husband is arrested for preaching Christianity, and her life becomes even more difficult. She and her children do survive World War II. And then take us to when the Korean War breaks out and how her life changes even more then.
Yeah, it's interesting because she ends up marrying somebody who is gracious to her and decides to give her children a proper name, and then he gets arrested during the colonial era because he is a minister, and he gets caught up in a difficult situation by his colleagues. When the Korean War occurs, that period in 1950, it should have been a very happy time for the Koreans because the colonial era had ended with the defeat of the Japan in World War II. However, actually, after the colonial era from 1945 until 1950, it was so difficult for the Koreans around the world because they essentially lost their nation and it became divided and there was so much instability and a great deal of persecution and war. So what's really so sad about the Koreans in Japan is they couldn't go back home. And consequently, they were stuck in this country that did not want them anymore. And they were very clear that they didn't want them anymore.
Minjin Lee is our guest. The new novel is Pachinko, and it is published by Grand Central. Tell us about Pachinko and how it plays such a role in this, the game itself, but also how you wanted to integrate it into the story.
You know, initially, I didn't know that I was going to write a novel called Pachinko. It was initially called Motherland because I thought I was really focusing on home. And then I interviewed so many Koreans in Japan, and almost every single person had some connection to this business. And pachinko is, as of last month, according to The Economist, a $203 billion business. It is actually a pillar of the Japanese economy. 1 out of 11 people in Japan play this game on a weekly basis. And it's an adult pinball gambling game. This entire business is seen with great suspicion, and a kind of moral repugnance is associated with this game and all the people who control it. And the majority of the people who control the pachinko industry, and there's so many different aspects of pachinko, not just the machines or the parlors, but even people who make bento lunches for them or send hot towels, all these things are part of this big, humongous economy of pachinko. And a lot of them are Korean Japanese. And the reason why I wanted to write about them is because I thought that it was so strange to me that the Koreans in Japan were not allowed to have regular jobs. Like, they couldn't aspire to be a postal worker or a teacher or a nurse or a police officer. And certainly, they would never have been allowed to have white-collar positions. Consequently, they had to go into small businesses like pachinko or yakiniku, which is barbecue restaurants that Koreans ran. And those were their only options. But after they joined these businesses, and some of them became very successful in them, the majority culture really saw them as criminal, dirty, illegal, immoral, deceitful. And these are kinds of the adjectives that are continually put upon the people in this community, although it is such an important part of the Japanese economy. And I found that paradox to be really unsettling. And I guess one of the things that I am saying is that pachinko is a rigged game, as in any single gambling game. So, for example, if you go to Las Vegas, you know that in general, the house always wins. But nevertheless, we all go to Las Vegas and we want to play maybe once every couple of years or something and try our luck. However, for the people in Japan who are Korean, they have to play their luck every day, even though that the game is totally rigged. And for me, that was an important metaphor of the way all of us can approach life, because sometimes we have to do things in which things are very unfair and stacked against us, but we can't quit.
We should note that one of Sanja's sons thrives in this business.
Yeah.
Talk a little bit about that relationship.
There are two boys in this story. The older is Noah, and the second is Moses. And Noah, the elder, is the child of the married man and the reason why Sanja had to take flight and move to Japan. The younger son, Moses, is the son of the minister. And he's actually a terrible student, doesn't really like school, likes to fight, and he has a lot of the indignation of being persecuted. And he's also kind of more funny and adaptive to the situation that he has. He falls in love with pachinko and the business and feels like a real gift at handling machines. And he's a real fixer. He can kind of do anything. And he adapts and he ends up owning several pachinko parlors and becomes a very wealthy man. And although he's a high school dropout and the son of a woman who was a peddler in an open market, he sends his son to a fancy international school and eventually educates him even at Columbia, who then comes back. And that is actually the transit of so many of the families that I interviewed, that I was really surprised by that ability that money could buy education and sort of global prestige. However, when they come back to Japan, they're still seen as, in some ways, a dirty, dishonest Korean.
You talk about this, that it's hard for you to fully understand generations of Koreans that have never fully been accepted in Japan. But when you went to talk to them, and many of the Japanese Koreans that you talked to weren't as concerned as you were.
No, not nearly. And as a matter of fact, I felt really stupid a lot of the times because I thought, wow, isn't this terrible? And how can this happen? And they would just say, this is just my life. This is just what you have, and you have to just play along, and you have to just try hard. And as a matter of fact, sometimes like they're almost consoling me, and I felt really embarrassed by that situation. And so, for example, what happened is I had multiple interviews, very in-depth and repeatedly with the same subjects. And so one person would say, no, I've never really faced discrimination and everything's really fine. And eventually, after a few hours, they would say something like, well, I was in high school and I really fell in love with this girl and she was so perfect and we really cared about each other, but I wasn't ever allowed to go to her house. And when I saw her again at university, she wouldn't acknowledge me because she knew that we had no future together since I was Korean. And so even though they would say something like, you know, it's fine the way things are, their anecdotes and their actual incidents were situations in which I think the average American would never tolerate. And I think that's what I realized about me, is that I'm actually an average American because my entitlement was so much greater than a person who grew up as a persecuted minority. And I think that my indignation and my shock were directly connected to the fact that I've been treated so well in this country. And I was given so many opportunities, so many teachers had backed me up, that people in publishing had been kind to me. And when I was an attorney, I had partners who took an interest in me and tried to kind of foster my growth. And I didn't feel like a foreigner in New York, and even though I wasn't even born here. I think that had a direct relationship to my level of shock. Whereas if you had grown up generationally seeing that your parents and your grandparents weren't accepted, why would you expect to be accepted?
History plays such a role in this novel. I guess it's cliche to say that it's a character in and of itself, but it is. It's very much there to guide us through this story.
Yeah, history is definitely the spine of this novel, and I don't think it's a cliche what you're saying. I think it's actually really smart to think of history as a character because I wanted it to be a really vibrant character, not something that we associate with just facts. Because history is a vibrant character, and sometimes it's very in your face, and sometimes it's sort of in the background, but it's never absent. And I think whether you think, oh, it's really tragic that 10 people were killed in St. Petersburg, and that is actually a historical fact that now occurred, you may actually have it in the forefront of your consciousness or not even at all, but it actually occurred, and it depends where you are and depends on who you are, because you may have a response to it if you grew up in St. Petersburg, but you may have no response to it and just see it as another sad story about the world today. And I think especially now, we modern people in the 21st century, we have this fire hose of information of history occurring in real time. And I think it's really difficult to process it. And yet, I think that we are constantly making small and large adjustments in relationship to all the current events, which it's history that's in the making. We just know much more than any other generation has ever had before.
It does. I mean, of course, as I read this book a few weeks ago, obviously this issue of immigration and that life as an immigrant, certainly because it's part of our history now and because it's part of our national discussion, it so stands out.
Yeah. You know, it's funny because America's entire genesis is based on immigration. It doesn't really exist. It's almost like Australia. Like there are certain countries that are new. And by new, I mean, you know, a couple hundred years old as opposed to several thousand years old, that requires immigration. And I think that the discussion lately and the headlines today are really not recognizable to me. It is recognizable to me in certain moments in history where I can say, yes, there was a point in California in the 19th century in which the Chinese were unwanted. Or we can say that the Irish were treated very poorly when they first came to New York after the potato famine because they were considered negative things. And of course, with every generation, it started to change because every generation in America has to be the lowest immigrant. And that's its history. However, I do think that immigrants are assimilated into this country in a way that they're not assimilated into many countries, not just Japan. Even Korea has a very sad history and a tragic history the way they don't integrate foreigners. And I think that in light of a global sense of history, a place like America is a very, very special place.
And something do you think that we take for granted?
Well, it's funny that you say that because when I was living in Japan and I met a lot of very cosmopolitan people in media as well as in finance, very often Americans who live abroad would say very mean things about America because it to sort of act as if they were sort of above everything, like they were global citizens or they're transnational and they were they didn't see their identity as American but almost as a global person. And they would say these really obnoxious things about Americans. And very often I would actually go to the mat and start fighting because I thought, how could you say these things? Because it's so great. And the example that I always went back to again and again is just how generous Americans were to the poor in Japan. I was so struck by how every single volunteer organization in Japan in which the poor are protected, it was usually founded by an American. It was run and staffed by Americans because the history in America of volunteering is so strong, and it's such an old history in America, to regularly see that charity is part of our lives. You know, that's the example that I gave because I thought, you know, I don't care if you're not impressed by the Iowa State Fair, and I don't care if you think that our politicians can make mistakes, but they're bad politicians everywhere. The thing that I was most struck by is how Americans have integrated so many different kinds of people and have also allowed them to be seen as citizens. And I think that was really interesting to me. And then I realized that I'm so loyal to America because I don't take it for granted. I don't take it for granted because I didn't just get it by being born. It was given to me. And I definitely see citizenship as a gift. And I think that if you interview a lot of immigrants who become naturalized, they do feel this incredible sense of loyalty to America.
Now that you have returned and you are in New York, you're living in the United States, does that change the scope of the next project?
My next project is called American Hagwon, and it'll complete the trilogy about the Koreans. And I'm writing about the role of education around the world. The word Hagwon, H-A-G-W-O-N, is a word for cram school. The Japanese word would be juku. And it's where kids in Korea, in South Korea, go after school. And they stay there from, let's say, 3 o'clock until almost midnight every day. And parents have to organize dinner and snack services because the kids don't come home because they're studying. Obviously, this is rather distressing because I can't imagine a childhood being entirely impeded by the need to do well in school. What's even more troubling is that these hagwons are spreading throughout America as well as all over the world. And it's because I think that the world feels a sense of anxiety about the importance of getting an elite education. So I'm really trying to take on this idea that education can be a beautiful thing, but it can also be a toxic thing because not every child is meant to have this sort of path.
Almost a commodity, right?
Yeah, it's a commodity. It's a business. And I think not all the participants in the business are well-intentioned for the benefit of the child. And I think that the parents are always probably guided by love for their child and their anxiety about the child's future. However, I think kids aren't meant to be, I guess, denied an opportunity to grow in addition to just schoolwork or tests.
Did I hear you correctly when you said of finishing this cycle? So when you are done, do you want to move away from Korea?
You know, I don't know. I do feel this real, I guess, compulsion to write this third book about the Koreans. Mm-hmm. And I know there are many, you know, wonderful Asian American authors out there who are writing not about Asian American issues or Asian issues. But I guess for me, I feel the lack for me about these stories, and they're interesting to me. I hope they're interesting to other people. Even when I was working on Pachinko, I was really concerned because there's not a single novel written originally in English about the Korean Japanese. So when I was working on it, and I was working on it for such a long time, I kind of thought that I was really stupid because maybe nobody wanted this book. You know, it makes sense. If it doesn't exist, maybe it's because nobody wants it. And I got really, really down because I was reading all the academic texts, and there's, you know, maybe 40, 50 books that are academic texts about the Korean Japanese. But even then, maybe two people had read it, and it's usually kind of a peer-reviewed kind of thing. I thought, well, I have to finish it. I have to finish it because I felt this compulsion. And right now, I feel this real compulsion to write about the American Hagwon, to understand the role of education for Koreans around the world. And, you know, maybe after I finish, I can just go to Disney World. I'm not sure. But I think I might need a break after. A break is good.
Min Jin Lee's new novel is Pachinko. It's published by Grand Central. Thank you so much for being with us. What a great pleasure.
Oh, Joe, thank you so much.
We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org. And you can listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast or at wamc.org. Sarah LaDuke produces our program. Bookmark us for next week. And thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.